This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast. Broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they live upon the earth. And also, this program, as I always say, is vital for all people. We here at DavidDuke.com are consistent. We don't preach one thing for ourselves and another thing for the other peoples of the world. We want to preserve European heritage, culture, faith, tradition, values, and even the unique genetic character that make us look and feel and be the way that we are. We want to preserve ourselves. We feel this is a natural condition for all people and all living things upon the earth. If we should preserve the Rocky Mountain cougar or the great whales of the Pacific or the great African elephant, certainly the different kinds and expressions of humanity have a right to be preserved as well. And the real minority on the face of this planet is certainly the European people. We are a small minority and we have very low birth rates, about 1.25, and we have, on top of that, massive immigration into our respective countries. And if this continues, we lose our identity. We lose what we are, and we cease to exist in the character that we have had for tens of thousands of years. At the same time, we want to preserve Western culture. We don't believe in things called colonialism. I don't believe that America should have 67 military bases all over the world. I think that's totally against even the vision of our founding fathers in America. Patrick Buchanan and I have said it pretty clearly for a long time. We have a choice in the United States between empire and republic. And what's going on is we're losing our republic and losing our freedoms in this quest for empire. The interesting thing is that it's not an American empire, really. It's not an empire on behalf of the American people. We are not receiving, as Americans, any real benefit from this Iraq war. We're certainly not more secure. We're paying much higher prices for gasoline than we ever did. We didn't get a penny a drop of oil from this war. This was a war fought for the interest of Israel. A very small radical minority has domination over the media and over the government policy of the United States. And the media does often lie about many subjects. Today I'm going to do my final part on the events during the Second World War called popularly the Holocaust, a term that was invented and created in the 1970s. And over the years, the Holocaust story has changed dramatically. Now, I'm not a person that says there weren't atrocities and terrible atrocities against Jews in the Second World War. At the same time, I know there were atrocities, terrible atrocities against Germans, against many other people during that war. 7 to 9 million Germans perished at the end of the war with ethnic cleansing and wholesale genocide in the eastern parts of what was then Germany, East Prussia, for instance, Königsberg, which is now Kaliningrad. These places were ethnically cleansed. These people were killed, raped, murdered. They were forced out of their homes in winter. We also had a policy of saturation bombing of cities. The bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you may say it had military objectives to save American military lives. It was still an attack that burned to death, alive, tens of thousands of men, women, and children in their homes. And that constitutes a war crime by today's standards. And I believe that the only way we can know the truth about any event of history is to really examine both sides. And I think it's appalling that there are people today in prison in Europe for simply having a different opinion about an historical event, even though these individuals decry any sort of tyranny, they decry any sort of murder or atrocities against individuals. They just say and disagree with some of the aspects of the official Holocaust story as sold to us by the media. But we know the media is always right, correct? Remember, in the days and the ramp-up of the Iraq war, remember what the leading newspapers, the most authoritative newspapers in the United States of America said. For instance, the Washington Post, on February 2nd, 2003, under a headline, Irrefutable, a headline with the name Irrefutable, told its readers in no uncertain terms, quote, after Secretary of State Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations Security Council yesterday, it's hard to imagine how anyone could doubt that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction. Well, as you all know, after spending $1 billion of our taxpayers' money to try to find these weapons after we occupied Iraq, we came to the conclusion, our own American forces came to the conclusion that Saddam had destroyed these weapons just as he said he had in 1992. There were no weapons. Anything, any historical event, any current event, when we are not allowed to doubt, then we might as well say we want to be lied to and we don't want to know the truth. Doubting is how you reach the truth in any subject. Debate is how you reach the truth. Discussion is how you reach the truth. When you start threatening people, when you say to people, we're going to put you in jail for 5 years, such as Gamma Rudolph, or 3 years, such as historian David Irving, for having a different opinion, how in the world are you going to come to the truth about any issue or any idea? Well, today I'm going to continue and give you the final part of my Holocaust Inquiry chapter. I'd like to note that the chapter is not called Holocaust Denial. It's simply a Holocaust Inquiry. And it basically talks about some of the revisionist viewpoints and the positions that they take. I take no ultimate position on the Holocaust in this book. In fact, in Europe and the world today, you can't if you want to stay out of jail. But what I do offer is the evidence or the ideas of those who have questions about the Holocaust and why there should be freedom of speech on this issue. Certainly enough questions are raised that there should be freedom of speech and inquiry in this issue. So we're going to go into that, and tomorrow we're going to deal with the immigration crisis from my book, Jewish Supremacism. I appreciate all of your support, and I hope that you enjoy this next installment of Jewish Supremacism, and this is from Chapter 12, A Holocaust Inquiry. This section is called Motives for the Holocaust Story. It starts with a quotation from Encarta Encyclopedia on the Holocaust by Raoul Hilberg, the leading Jewish Holocaust historian. Quote, pressure was placed on the Allied powers to establish a permanent haven in Palestine for Jewish survivors. The establishment of Israel 3 years after Germany's defeat was thus an after-effect of the Holocaust. During every war, there is propaganda. In modern warfare, it has become a powerful psychological weapon. While propaganda has no necessary relation to truth, it can be used in a nation's own forces as well on those of the enemy. During the First World War, the British War Office issued dispatches saying that German soldiers would enjoy themselves by hoisting up the babies of Belgium on their bayonets, and furthermore, that they boiled the babies' bodies to derive the phosphates used in munitions. After the war, the British War Office confirmed that these stories were blatant falsehoods. In the Second World War, in an expanding age of radio, movies, and mass circulation newspapers and magazines, propaganda became ever more refined and powerful. Jews who exercised considerable power in the American media and British government began circulating stories about German atrocities in the 1930s. And the stories escalated with the coming of war. As the revisionist Barnes Review points out, just as Germans were accused of boiling babies in the First World War, Germans were now accused of making soap from the bodies of their murdered victims. However, this time it took almost half a century for the historical truth to vanquish the soap story lie, and the blatant falsehood, it's still often repeated. As a student often in the basement of the Louisiana State University Library, I surveyed a great many magazines published between 1945 and 50, and I found compelling reasons why the war propaganda did not stop after the end of the war. The guns in Europe had scarcely been silenced when a new war began that was vital to the worldwide Jewish community. A massive Jewish invasion and ensuing war began in Palestine for the creation of the Zionist State of Israel. Its success depended to a great degree on the Holocaust story. In his Encarta Encyclopedia article, Raul Hilberg accurately depicts the establishment of Israel as a, quote, after effect of the Holocaust. Actually, the establishment of Israel was not so much an after effect of the Holocaust as it was an after effect of the Holocaust story. The realities of the Holocaust were not as important as the perception that there was, in fact, a Holocaust. Today, there are important historical questions concerning the sinking of the USS Maine preceding the Spanish-American War, the Gulf of Tonkin incident preceding heavy American involvement in Vietnam, and whether Lusitania, which the Germans sank in the First World War, was illegally carrying munitions. The importance of these decisive incidents lay more in the public's perception of them than whatever their factual basis may have been at the time. The same is true of the Holocaust. The Zionist dream of Israel needed a Holocaust, or the most monstrous Holocaust imaginable, to further their aims. Modern Israel could not have been established without the story of the 6 million. The creation of the Jewish state depended on the massive influx of Jews from all over the world into Palestine in a successful war of terror against both the British, who administered the region under a League of Nations mandate, and against the region's native inhabitants. The displaced Jewish populations of Europe were a tremendous source of immigration to Palestine. Without that invasion, it is doubtful the relatively small pre-war Jewish population there could have wrested control from the British and the native Palestinians. The Zionist military takeover of Palestine required vast economic, military, and political support from around the world. It entailed the terrorizing of the Palestinian majority, driving them from their homes and lands and denying them their civil and political rights. Only the perpetuation of the Holocaust story could make these crimes somehow tolerated by the world. Sympathy for the Jews, deeply stirred by recollections of the Holocaust, made whatever grievous offenses committed by the Jews against the Palestinians, no matter how unjust, seemed trivial. The Holocaust story has generated tens of billions of dollars of aid from the United States and even greater amounts from Germany in reparations. Perhaps most importantly, the Holocaust was the fuel that fired the flame of Jewish Zionism all over the world. Recital of the Holocaust united Jews worldwide and elicited the huge monetary and political support necessary for the establishment and maintenance of Israel. After 50 years of almost unbroken conflict with the Palestinians and her Arab neighbors, Israel still relies heavily upon American and German support. Israel is America's biggest annual recipient of foreign aid, just as it has been since her establishment. Constant harping on the Holocaust keeps the money flowing from both Jews and non-Jews, and forms a subtle excuse for every injustice committed against the Arabs. Noam Goldman, president of the World Jewish Congress, wrote a popular book called The Jewish Paradox, published by Grosset and Dunlop in 1978. Quote, "The Germans will have paid out a total of $80 billion without the German reparations that started coming through during the first 10 years as a state. Israel would not have half of its present infrastructure. All the trains in Israel are German. The ships are German. And the same goes for electrical installations and a great deal of Israel's industry. And that is setting aside the individual pensions paid to survivors. Israel today receives hundreds of millions of dollars in German currency each year. In some years, the sums of money received by Israel from Germany has been as much as double or treble the contribution made by collections from international Jewry." Unquote. In this amazing book, Goldman admits that even during the war, the Zionists were planning war crimes and reparations from Germany. During the war, the World Jewish Congress had created an Institute of Jewish Affairs in New York. Its headquarters are now in London. The directors were two great Lithuanian Jewish jurists, Jacob and Nehemiah Robinson. Thanks to them, the Institute worked out two completely revolutionary ideas, the Nuremberg Tribunals and German reparations. The Institute's idea was that Nazi Germany ought to pay after its defeat. The German reparations would first have to be paid to people who had lost their belongings to the Nazis. Further, if, as we hope, the Jewish state was created, the Germans would pay compensation to enable the survivors to settle there. The first time this idea was expressed was during the war, in the course of a conference in Baltimore, unquote. The Nuremberg trials were presented to the public as an effort by the Allies to levy justice on war criminals. In The Jewish Paradox, Goldman admits that the Nuremberg trials and the idea of German reparations were originated not by the Allies, but by Zionists before any evidence of a Holocaust, and that the compensation would be vital to the foundation of Israel. Since the Second World War, the Holocaust story has engendered tens of billions of dollars from the United States and even greater amounts from Germany in reparations. The staggering sum, easily exceeding $150 billion, would certainly provide a powerful motive to Israel and world Zionism to perpetuate the sensationalized Holocaust story. Another possible motive for keeping the propaganda alive became apparent to me as I read the stacks of 1940s magazines in the LSU library. I found numerous stories predicting the imminent rebirth of Nazism. Many of them claimed fancifully that secret hoards of gold existed that would fund the neo-Nazi movement in Germany and all over the world, including North and South America. Associating the Holocaust with Nazism was certainly the most effective way to rebuke the National Socialist philosophy. Of course, the Holocaust not only rebukes the Nazis, it insulates the Jews from practically any criticism. It is also a psychological weapon in the hands of the Jewish-led egalitarian movement, for the mass media never seemed to miss an opportunity to link racial understanding and science to the Nazi horrors, except, of course, for Jewish racial horrors against Palestinians. In advancing the Holocaust story, the Jewish-dominated media had a willing partner in the Allied governments. At the end of the war, with Europe in ruins, tens of millions dead, and half of Europe under communist tyranny, many could be forgiven for asking if involvement in the original Polish-German war had been worth it. The Holocaust story provided powerful emotional justification. I enjoyed reading Raymond Chandler murder mysteries when I was in college. When studying the Holocaust, I remembered that in making a criminal case, the prosecution shows that the defendant has a motive to commit the offense and the opportunity to do so. Powerful Jewish interests certainly had the motive to create and promote the Holocaust story in its most extreme rendition. And with their domination of the media, they certainly had the opportunity. There are literally thousands of books in print focusing on aspects of the Holocaust and countless magazine articles, speeches, sermons, documentaries, novels, plays, and movies tell us of its horror. An overwhelming number of the authors of material on the Holocaust are themselves Jewish. Is it likely that Jews, who passionately believe in the unspeakable horrors of the Holocaust, every aspect of the Holocaust, can write objectively about it? Could Elie Wiesel write an unbiased account of Nazi Germany or the Holocaust? Or could Adolf Hitler, were he alive, write an unbiased one of Wiesel and the Second World War? Elie Wiesel writes, and I quote, "Every Jew somewhere in his being should set apart a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate, for what the German personifies and for what persists in the German. To do otherwise would be a betrayal of the dead." Unquote. Now imagine if a Russian survivor of the murderous gulags under Jewish Bolshevism made a statement saying that, and I quote, every Russian somewhere in his being should set aside a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate, for what the Jew personifies and for what persists in the Jew. To do otherwise would be a betrayal of the dead. I don't believe a Russian who would have written those lines would have won a Nobel Prize. In fact, in the Europe of today, he would be jailed and called an evil anti-Semite. The real power of the Holocaust story has been in the human emotion it evokes. It is the tearful remembrances of an elderly Jewish survivor, the coquettish words of Anne Frank, and the photographs and newsreels of emaciated and mangled bodies that are ingrained in the consciousness of all of us. It is the pictorial record that is the real proof of the Holocaust, for we have all seen its victims in their terrible poses of death. However, similar pictures could be shown from many wars. We could see the millions of victims of communism under Trotsky's Red Army or Stalin's purges. We could see the women and children who died by the thousands in the British-run concentration camps of the Boer War. We could see the remains of the tens of thousands of men, women, and children who were burned alive at Dresden or Hamburg. We could see the dead of the killing fields of Cambodia or the blood-drenched jungles of Rwanda. But we do not see these victims in photographs and films day after day, year after year. These other victims of war have no multi-million dollar memorial among the national monuments of Washington, D.C. They have no political lobby, no Hollywood promoters. To remember them doesn't suit the agenda of those who decide what the public will view and hear. During the coming century, as communications flow with greater ease and rapidity, more people will challenge many of the premises and allegations of the Holocaust story. Errors and falsehoods will fall before vigorous cross-examination and intellectual challenge. Some parts of the Holocaust story may be shored up. Each day, the story unravels, though, a bit more, becoming increasingly untenable. The truth grows incrementally. Terror and suppression will no longer suffice to block its advance. Truth will prevail someday, triumphant in its naked power. I cannot say with absolute certainty that some parts of the Holocaust story did not occur, just as the leading exterminationists allege. But certainly there is now enough contrary evidence and reasonable questions to warrant a full and open inquiry and debate, freedom of speech on Holocaust dogma. We cannot know the full truth until dissenting opinions and free inquiries into the Holocaust are allowed. Those historians and scholars who harbor doubts about aspects of the Holocaust orthodoxy must be allowed to investigate and analyze, and then to present their findings without fear of retaliation of the sort suffered by David Irving. After researching and questioning elements of the Holocaust story, I came to realize that those who challenge parts of it are no more unjustified than those who dispute the establishment's version of the Kennedy lone assassination theory. The difference is that there is less political, economic, social, or religious repercussions when challenging the Warren Commission findings. To simply ask pertinent questions about any aspect of the Holocaust story will bring down upon oneself the unbridled wrath of those who dominate the media and who support Israel. I have paid dearly for my apostasy, and this book will probably exact an even greater personal cost. In America, if a researcher dares to publish and then publicly discuss the issue, it can result in the loss of his livelihood and even physical endangerment. In Canada and Europe, it has meant revocation of university degrees and loss of employment, professional standings, pensions, businesses, and in addition, even imprisonment and physical attack. As I write these words, news has come to me that the French nationalist leader Jean-Marie Le Pen has been convicted by a French court and fined thousands of dollars for simply saying in a conversation with a journalist that the gas chambers were a, quote, footnote of the Second World War. Sir Winston Churchill, in his monumental sixth volume, The Second World War, has no mention of gas chambers, not even a footnote. The same can be said for Eisenhower's crusade in Europe. Perhaps the Zionists can arrange for a posthumous trial for these two men who did not pay proper homage to the Holy Holocaust. After Le Pen's comment, the European director of the Wiesenthal Center demanded the waiver of Le Pen's European parliamentary immunity to make him liable for prosecution and ineligible to run for elected office. A society that does not allow free discussion, inquiry, commentary, and debate is not free. The greater the fear of government and media for an idea, the more intense the suppression. In the case of politically incorrect ideas about the Holocaust, this fear has reached hysterical proportions. A government or media establishment that fears certain ideas suppresses them not because the ideas are weak, but because they are powerful. Not because those ideas are refutable, but because they are convincing. If it really believes the ideas to be weak, it has no urgency to suppress them. If we are to know the true story of the Holocaust, there must be freedom of inquiry, freedom to question, and freedom to doubt. If there is one thing I've learned in my political life, it is to question. We must have free speech and press, free inquiry and discussion. Before we can know what is true or untrue, fact or fiction, we must hear all sides. This holds true for every issue before us, including the phenomenon that produces such incredible hysteria, the Holocaust, spelled with a capital H. The Holocaust increasingly assumes the dimensions of a religion. It is a sort of death and redemption theme that takes on the image of an innocent people being slaughtered but rising in an aura of unassailable holiness. There are refurbished concentration camps as shrines and pilgrimages to them, holy writs full of saints and sinners, and temples such as the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Anyone who questions even the slightest detail of it is a heretic who deserves scorn and derision at the least, but more preferably, the loss of his livelihood and his imprisonment. The writings of the blasphemers must be confiscated and burned. If the heretical works somehow, even to a small degree, find their way to the public, the authors and their works must be systematically demeaned and ridiculed. Not only is the Holocaust taking on religious dimensions, it has become a huge world industry generating billions of dollars. The Holocaust story is a source of billions of dollars of reparations from Germany, billions more in American support, and billions more in what can be defined as a huge and powerful blackmail racket. Dr. Norman Finkelstein exposes the racket in a recent interview with the magazine Counterpunch. He spoke out quite courageously, even though he has faced vicious attacks from the ADL and other powerful Jewish organizations. Quote, and question, a spokesman for the World Jewish Congress suggested that you should be grateful to organizations such as themselves for the compensation that your parents received. Is there not some truth in that? Were it not for the awareness-raising campaigns of these bodies, Holocaust survivors would not have been compensated at all? Question. And Norman Finkelstein answers, these organizations, frankly, bring to mind an insight of my late mother, that it's no accident that Jews invented the word chutzpah. They steal, and I do use the word with intent. 95% of the money is earmarked for the victims of Nazi persecution, and then throw you a few crumbs while telling you to be grateful. It's very hard to sink much lower than to turn the colossal suffering of the Jewish people during World War II into an extortion racket. I really think that not even Julius Streicher, leading anti-Semitic publisher in 1930s Germany, were he editing Der Stürmer today, could have conjured up the image of Jews huckstering their dead. But that's exactly what this gang of wretched crooks have done. They have disgraced the memory of the Jewish people, suffering on the one hand by turning it into an extortion racket. If there were any doubt left, I would point to the recent London Times article headlined, "Swiss Holocaust Cash Revealed to Be a Myth." That is, all the claims against the Swiss bankers were fantastic concoctions of the Holocaust hustlers. But then, after turning Jewish suffering into an extortion racket, to then deny the actual victims these monies extorted. It is very difficult to imagine sinking any lower on a moral level than that. If they were all put behind bars, it wouldn't be yet, in my opinion, be a just punishment. Finkelstein goes on to point out that if he were not Jewish, his book would not even have been published at all. Question, do you think the Holocaust industry would have been published were you not the Jewish son of Holocaust survivors? Finkelstein laughs and says, no, I have no doubt about that. First of all, it just got barely published as a son of Holocaust survivors. If I weren't, there would be no chance at all. I would have been buried alive. Just the other day, I was speaking to someone who I cannot name for this interview, who met with a high government official in Germany who we both knew. My friend asked him about the questions raised in my book concerning the number of surviving slave laborers and whether the German government knew that the numbers had been grossly inflated to justify the extortion of huge amounts of money. His response was that, of course we knew what he was saying was true. But a decision was made early on to go with the blackmail because, quote, we were afraid of a huge anti-Semitic reaction being unleashed in Germany, unquote. The Holocaust legend lives on, fueling intense ethnic solidarity among Jews and collective hatred toward Gentiles. Among Gentiles, the chronic replay of the Holocaust story destroys our most elementary psychological defenses against Jewish extremism and Jewish supremacism. Actually, the greatest Holocaust born of ethnocentrism was the mass murder of tens of millions of Christians by the Jewish-led Bolsheviks in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. It seems sadly ironic so little is focused on that Holocaust of Holocausts in our age, though. Events and their significance are defined as supremacist Jews choose to define them. Holocaust terminology remains the exclusive preserve of the Jewish victims of the Second World War. The Jewish Holocaust is sacredly held apart from all other loss of life. There are Jews, and then there's the rest of humanity, the small g, Gentiles of the world. Next section is the mother of all Holocausts. It would be far more appropriate to describe the entire Second World War as a Holocaust rather than simply the sufferings of the Jews. The bombings and burning of Europe's most beautiful cities and artworks, the death of tens of millions of the bravest and fittest young men, and the ruthless uprooting, starvation, rape, and murder of tens of millions of innocent civilians from all nations and all ethnic groups of Europe. That was the greatest Holocaust the world has ever known. The civilized world will feel the cultural and genetic effects of the Second World War for many generations to come. The British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain put it succinctly when he said that the German-Polish border dispute wasn't worth the blood of one English grenadier. All those born during and since the conflict grew up with the catechism of parents and press about the good war. If the death of 50 million human beings is a good war, then what exactly is a bad one? Naturally, the same forces that have publicized the Holocaust have emphasized the necessity of the war, and the Nuremberg tribunals decreed the ultimate war guilt of the Germans. Seeking to end the 20-year Polish subjugation of Eastern German territory, Germany had invaded Poland. At that point, it was a border war, with minimal loss of life and little bombing of cities or civilians. The war widened as France and England declared war on Germany, and soon it was a world war, ultimately the greatest human carnage in history. In many nations, there were those who wanted war. There were Germans looking to the east for Lebensraum, Poles who would rather have war than give back their Versailles expropriated German territory. Among the French, there were those jealous of their German rivals, and among the British, some were fearful of the economic, political, and military power of a united Europe under the leadership of Germany. Those forces and others helped create the Holocaust of the Second World War. But let us not forget one other group that bears a heavy responsibility also for this Holocaust of war: the worldwide forces of organized Jewry. In 1933, the World Jewish Congress proclaimed war on Germany. For 6 years, in every nation of the West, they exacerbated every national grievance and paranoia. They ran inflammatory articles about Germany in the Jewish-owned or controlled press. They used their great financial power to advantage. They used their powerful political and media influence to agitate for war and feed the fires of hate, a fire still stoked by the media 55 years after the fact. We Americans, along with the British, Germans, French, Poles, Russians, Italians, and others, slaughtered millions of European women and children, killed and maimed our young men, and burned our most sacred works of beauty in our European cradle of culture and civilization. When I was very young, I developed a feeling of guilt for slavery and for Jim Crow. I shed that guilt as I came to realize that our race has given far more to the people of the earth than it's taken. As I came to understand the realities of the Second World War, feelings of guilt came upon me again. But this time, not for what my race has done to others, but for what we've done to ourselves. Ultimately, we have no one to blame for that carnage more than ourselves. The Second World War was the most destructive and devastating occurrence in the long history of European mankind. Communism raped half of Europe and was unleashed across the planet, killing and enslaving millions more before it burned itself out. With their Pyrrhic victory, Jewish supremacists consolidated their power, and the result of the 21st century now begins with Zionist hegemony in the highest echelons of media and political power in the United States, and powerfully influential in other areas on the earth. At the end of the Second World War, as supremacist Jews invaded Palestine, their confederates in Europe and America planned a different form of invasion for European and American homelands, an immigration invasion, as part of their age-old tactic of divide and conquer. In the early years of the 21st century, we can now easily envision the demographic and genetic catastrophe that looms ahead for many nations. An ancient hatred is now being settled by people who never forget and never forgive. And today, although our Jewish antagonists appear on the threshold of complete victory as they busily lay the foundations for their New World Order, it is still not their power that threatens us. It is our own weakness. Our Achilles' heel has proved to be our naivete. If we learn the truth of the Holocaust, then such naivete will end, and we may yet foil the plans for the eradication of all the unique and diverse expressions of mankind through the New World Order. Norman Finkelstein points out the hypocrisy of the Holocaust industry in their use of the Holocaust as the ultimate justification for the murder, imprisonment, torture, and dispossession of millions of Palestinians. But it is not only Palestinians that owe their occupation to the bludgeon of the Holocaust. So does much of the occupation of key positions of power in the European-American world by Jewish extremists. The Palestinians, the European-Americans, and truly all the peoples of the world must not sacrifice their freedom and survival upon the altar of the Holocaust. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the final part of the Holocaust chapter, and tomorrow we're going to go into what's called the Jewish-led invasion, about the massive immigration coming into the United States, into Europe, and the role that Jewish extremists have had in changing the demographics of both the United States, Canada, and the world, and how they use immigration as a weapon in their arsenal, in their war against our heritage. That sounds funny to a lot of people, but it's kind of interesting to find that these Jewish extremists, these Jewish supremacists, these same Jewish supremacists that support the State of Israel with very tough immigration laws, and even laws against intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews. They don't even recognize a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew as a legal marriage in Israel. That the same people that support this racial supremacist State of Israel are the same people that tell us we must have so-called multiculturalism and open our gates and our borders in America and Europe. The documentation's all there in the next chapter. I'll see you tomorrow, and I appreciate very much your support. It's your gifts, both economic and physical, because it takes some labor, but I hope you use your fingers on your keyboards today and get out this message around your neighborhood, around your state, around your country, around your world. Because if you don't spread the truth, who is going to do it? Thanks so much, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukes.com.